We'll be reading Hebrews 10, verses 35 through 39. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which is a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteousness shall one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. Brother Jew.
You might have been told before or given the advice to not ask a question that you don't want the answer to. Maybe you've asked your spouse how you look in a certain hat. You know, is this a look that I can pull off? They tell you, are you really asking? Do you want me to be honest? Don't ask a question that you don't want the answer to. You know, how is our football team going to do this year? Something along those lines. Typically, we give that advice to be cautious because you are asking a question where the answer is in some way going to be too painful. You're just really not going to want to hear it. It's going to bring up a truth you would rather not dwell upon. The prophet Habakkuk, or Habakkuk, finds himself in this situation after coming to Jehovah with burning questions about the state of the world. And in the midst of troubling answers, the Lord delivers a seemingly simple statement that has resounded for centuries since. It is quoted three times in the New Testament. The just shall live by faith. It's one of the keys to processing or accepting the response that God makes to the prophet's response, or excuse me, to the prophet's questions, and it remains for us still a vital concept in our walk before God. And so I want to investigate that statement, the words surrounding it, and what it actually might mean for us to be walking by faith. I invite you to turn to that book, if you would, please, Habakkuk or Habakkuk. As I said, I've heard it said both ways. I think one is probably closer to the truth than the other, but I grew up with one, and that's the one I'll be using most times this morning if I don't go in and out. While you're finding the book of Habakkuk, please let me welcome you this morning and extend my thanks for your being here. We have many who are visiting with us. I don't know what all has brought each of you our way. Some are here for the first time. Some might be just passing through the area. Some might have found us through some interest in approaching people of God and coming to listen to the Word of God, coming to worship the Creator of all things. Whatever it is that has led you through our doors this morning, please know that we're thankful for it and hope that the time we spend together in study will be useful for you. I think the question we are essentially answering this morning, what does it mean to live by faith, is one of the most crucial that we can ask in our lives, because that is one of the greatest needs in our lives, to walk by faith. That is how salvation is found. That is how God is found. And so if I can in any way prepare you in your life to do that a little bit better, I'll have considered this a success for my time this morning, and I hope that all things we do will please God, of course. As we look at this book of prophecy together, a short Old Testament book by an author about whom we know nothing. We don't really know anything else about this man. We aren't given a specific time frame for when he lived, what tribe he was from, who his people were, what his temperament was like, how old he was when he wrote this. We just don't have anything except for the words that survive. But the setup of the book itself is really rather opposite from what we usually have in a book of prophecy. Time and again, when you read those literary prophets, almost always, God chooses a messenger and he sends them to the people to bring a charge against them. He tabs Isaiah or Jeremiah or whoever it might be and he says, go to the people of Israel and tell them this. And it's usually bad news. They've done something wrong. God has a bone to pick with them. He is bringing a suit against them. Oftentimes legal language is used. He's going to bring a complaint against the people. That's almost always how it happens. But in Habakkuk, the roles are reversed. Instead, it is the prophet who approaches God with a complaint of sorts from the people. He stands as the representative, the agent almost, of the righteous few who are left in Judah and is appealing to God. Here is what our complaint is. What can you do about this? Oftentimes, we try to put ourselves in the prophet's shoes or the psalmist or whoever it might be. That can be a key way of helping to understand a biblical text, to try to understand them from the point of view of the people who are writing those things or saying those things, the people about whom we're reading. We like to try to transport ourselves in some way into that time and place and think, what would it have been like? What would they have been thinking? In this case, it's not really so hard. Habakkuk looks around at a wicked nation. The nation of Judah, probably in the late stages before they are taken away as captives to the nation of, well, to the area of Babylon, and will not have a kingdom of their own for centuries after that fact. For all intents and purposes, this is the destruction of the nation of Judah as we know it, that he is about to witness. And in those death throes, in that final circling of the drain, this is the time that Habakkuk occupies. Wickedness rules. Everywhere he looks, people plunder and take by force what is not theirs. Violence is common, and it seemingly never goes punished. No one really cares. In fact, rule of law itself is corrupted. Neither man's laws nor God's laws are respected or followed. And in this abandonment of God, the rich and the powerful exploit and destroy those who are beneath them. When he looks around, he sees nothing is fair. Now again, in many regards, this is not so difficult to put ourselves into his shoes and to consider the state of our nation around us, where we can easily see wickedness on every hand. We can easily see violence from almost every quarter. We can see a disregard and a disrespect for laws, both of man and God. We can easily see the corruption that is found in the highest places as well as in the lowest, even among those who are meant to govern us. We see a casual disregard for human life. We see an inability or a disinterest and systems of justice to actually carry out that for which they have been appointed. We see all of the very same things that the prophet is dealing with. In this situation, he asks, first of all, a question. The basic format of the book, in the first two chapters at least, will be two questions followed by two answers. So Habakkuk's first question, there in verse 2 to begin, "How long shall I cry and you will not hear?" He is approaching Jehovah with this question, essentially. What will it take to get your attention? When are you going to step in and do something to fix this? Men can't find justice from our earthly rulers, so when are we going to be able to find justice from God? Well, God's answer follows. Beginning in verse 5, going down through verse 11. He tells Habakkuk, "You want to know when I'm going to do something? You'll live to see it happen. I'm going to do something in your days that will astound utterly." Already, God was preparing to use the Chaldeans, as they're referred to here in this chapter, the Babylonians. He will use them as an instrument of punishment. Already at this time, they were a terrifying force. They had begun spreading out their empire with a dreadful inevitability. You would be able to stand up to them for a while, and it seems most nations of the time even knew this, understood it on some level, that they were just not a match for what was coming against them. You could stand for a while, but eventually they would topple you, they would destroy you. The best that you had as an option was making some form of peace that was never advantageous to you. It was going to hurt. It was going to humiliate you. It was going to take from your money. It was going to take from your livelihood. It was going to take from the welfare and the happiness of you and all of your people. But it was better than being slaughtered and tortured. They were this inevitable, dreadful presence. They were eating up lands and peoples with an insatiable appetite for conquest. There is not a nation or king strong enough to stand against them. Many have tried, and all have failed. And now God tells his prophet, Judah will be no different. I'm sending them against you. As you would expect, this is not the answer that Habakkuk wants. This in no way eases his conscience. He wanted to know, all right, the people of Judah are wicked. The leaders in Judah are unjust. God, what are you going to fix that? And God's answer is, I'm going to destroy the nation and I'm going to punish you. And once again, it's easy to sympathize with his unease from our own perspective. Because we would find ourselves in that same position, wouldn't we? Sure, we see the rotting wickedness within our own country, but if we were to look elsewhere to find a nation that's faring any better spiritually, where would we turn? Where is the nation that is honoring God in all of its ways? If we were to ask God to take action against the disgusting offenses that America is growing to be known for, and if he decided to punish or to even destroy our country with another political power, isn't it a near certainty that our enemy would be at least as wicked as we are? And we'd find ourselves saying, well, that isn't fair either. I wanted justice, but of a different kind. So Habakkuk's second question, beginning really in verse 12, maybe we can summarize it with these words of his. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Right now, that seems more like injustice than justice. We're bad, but they're worse, and you're going to let them win? That's your answer to all of this, Jehovah? You're going to send an even more grotesque, idolatrous, wicked nation against us to be the instrument of punishment? If you are a holy God who hates evil, how can you punish the lesser wicked with the greater? Habakkuk, to his great credit, in chapter 2 and verse 1, he knows the wiser course is to wait for God's answer in patience. And so he braces himself and does just that, hearing how God might correct him, as he says. So, God's second answer to this second question follows. He says, you're not wrong, Habakkuk. You're not wrong that they're worse. They are wicked. They're proud, they're bloodthirsty, they're greedy. Worst of all, they are idolatrous. They give no honor whatsoever to the one true God. But they have a role to fulfill first. There's a job for them. And it simply isn't their time yet to face the music. They too, Babylon as well as Judah, they would be weighed and measured and judged and found wanting. But God tells Habakkuk, not yet. The Lord is in his holy temple, and from this vantage point, he will see Babylon punished as well when their iniquity is full. Now, both of these responses to the questions that God is asked, or the complaints that God hears, both of these responses reveal critical elements of God's justice. Be attentive to what God is showing us about his judgments. First of all, it is certain, but secondly, it may not always be swift. Habakkuk asks him, aren't you doing anything? And God says, absolutely. Here's what it is. And then Habakkuk's second question is, but what are you going to do to them? And God says, you might just have to wait to see that. Certain, but not always swift. And so in light of that, the Lord reveals what the heart of his people must be if they are to truly live in accord with him. They trust in his judgment because it is certain. And they patiently wait to see it because it might be a long time in coming. This is crystallized in the great statement to which we're giving our attention this morning. Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, chapter 2, verse 4, but the just shall live by his faith. This is God revealing to his people what their response must be in light of the way his judgments work. And we'll unpack that passage in just a moment. The remainder of the book, just to finish giving a sort of overview of this prophecy. God in chapter 2, beginning in verse 5 through the end of the chapter, gives a scathing indictment of Babylon. We can see there all the evil that they were up to and would be up to. He sets out the charges that they'll be punished for when the time comes. And then in chapter 3, the prophet has this stirring prayer or song or both. He praises God for his power and his frequent salvation. He asks God that in wrath he would remember mercy. And above all, he expresses this quiet confidence that no matter what comes to pass, he will rejoice in the Lord. But let's get back for the time being to chapter 2 and verse 4. The just shall live by his faith. What does that mean? What is God trying to tell the people? What does it mean to live by faith? We can approach the answer first by looking at the wording of the statement itself, which may take on shades of meaning. It can actually be translated in slightly different ways, and depending on what version, what English version you are reading, and where you happen to find it. For instance, I mentioned it's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. The wording is a little bit different in some of those renditions. The Hebrew to English supplies several different possibilities. The Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, Greek translated from Hebrew, has slightly different wording depending on manuscript tradition. All this is reflected in slightly different wording you come across several times when you compare or contrast Paul's use of it, for instance, in Romans 1 or in Galatians 3 to that in Hebrews 10 that we read a moment ago. They might differ slightly depending on how things are actually translated. Some will say, for instance, that the just or the righteous will live by its faithfulness. The just will live by its faithfulness. In context, in Habakkuk chapter 2, that would be referring back to the revelation that God is talking about. We didn't read together verses 2 and 3, but there God is telling the prophet, write down the vision that I'm going to send you and make it so big and obvious that someone who's even running by would be able to see it. Make it a very plain sign almost. Put it on tablets and make it known, well known to everyone, because it's going to be important and it's absolutely trustworthy. In that sense then, if we were to find Habakkuk being told, the just shall live by its faithfulness, he would be essentially saying, the righteous lives by trusting the word of God. He lives by its faithfulness, by its reliability, and his confidence that what God has spoken will come to pass. That would be similar to another translation of this, that the righteous live by my faith, and that is God speaking. The righteous live by my faith or by my faithfulness. Again, that would be telling us that the righteous man sees Jehovah as faithful. Everything in his life is based upon the foundation that God will keep faith. When he promises, he will deliver. When he threatens, he will judge. When he speaks, he will be found faithful. And the just lives by that. He lives by God's faithfulness and reliability. These are all captured in a general sense by the most common translation, that the righteous man will live by his faith. Of course, his faith is a faith in God and a faith in what God has said. So his pattern of life reflects that trust in a certain and sure ally. Let's continue to sort of overanalyze the phrase a little bit and get to the finest point possible. And a few other questions might arise. I think these are just as easily answered when we understand what faith actually is, but they do help us to come to that conclusion. For instance, that statement, depending on where you put the emphasis almost, could mean maybe 2 chief possibilities. Is it simply giving a description of the just? In other words, God would be saying here, that a just or righteous person is one who lives by faith. It's a characteristic that he is explaining. The just shall live by faith. In other words, when you find a person who's living by faith, that means he's a just person. You've just described who that person actually is. Or is it revealing a need for the just? In other words, to say that he will live by his faith, almost as if to say that one can only survive through faith. If he is to live rather than die, if he is to be one who is not struck down with the proud, but who remains upright, he will live and survive and thrive only through the exercise of his faith. Well, if we're trying to discern one or the other, which is right, which is most accurate, my answer would be yes. They're both in mind. They're both what the point is. Both seem to be intended, included in the statement. The proud and the self-reliant in this prophecy find only certain doom. There is no living, there is no surviving outside of faith in God. You're going to fall. And so to be righteous before God, to survive where others are cast down, faith is the only way forward. That is how you know who the just man, the righteous man is. He lives by his faith. Another potential discussion, and maybe the most important, hinges on the key word itself, faith. Because you might be reading from a translation that says faithfulness. The just shall live by his faith, or the just shall live by his faithfulness. And here, please understand, I believe the modern weakening and abuse of the word faith is truly exposed. Because we have created a difference between those two words, faith and faithfulness, where I don't really think one exists. To many, faithfulness would indicate obedience, fidelity, a pattern of life, a pattern of action in life, behavior, in other words. Faith, on the other hand, would indicate belief, confidence that might yet remain in the realm of thought rather than action, simply what you think about something. So, in other words, you might say, you are faithful to your spouse. Or you are faithful in your attendance. We, in a religious context, almost always use that to talk about who's showing up in the pews, right? He's faithful. That means I see him a few times a week. Well, in that sense, the word faithful is being used to describe behavior. You do something. On the other hand, some would look at the idea of faith and see an idea of something that is purely mental. You have faith that your team is going to win a game. Or you have faith that your finances are going to turn around. And that means you have a confidence in a desired outcome, but it's one that I exert very little control over ultimately. It's just something I'm thinking about and I'm hoping for. I believe it will change, but I can't really do anything about it. But biblical faith never exists only in the mind, and biblical faithfulness cannot possibly be achieved purely through actions. The two are not separate from each other. I really like Bruckner in his writing capably, I think, illustrates the relationship here. If you view a bridge, think of a suspension bridge. Maybe this illustration works for me so well because I don't like heights. I don't like going out on anything where you don't have a lot of feet and feet and feet of solid ground underneath you. I remember going to the Space Needle in Seattle. Beth and I went to the Space Needle one time, and that you couldn't get out of that. You couldn't jump off of the edge of that if you tried to. I mean, they've got so many safety things. There's all kinds of netting and steel things that are meant to keep people in there. It's a balcony. You can look out through open air, but you would not be able to plummet to your death from that if you really wanted to and were set on doing that. But stepping out onto that little balcony, my palms start sweating and I got like a palpable pain in my legs. I don't like being out there in that open air. But picture, you're facing this suspension bridge that goes over a chasm. If I don't have faith that the bridge is going to hold me up, there's no way I'm going out there. I'm not going to do it. If that thing looks rickety, if there's a few planks missing, if it's making a creaking noise or something, I don't trust that it's going to work, so I'm not venturing out. I'm just not going to do it. We might say that another way. If I don't believe, I don't want to obey. If I say that I have faith in that bridge, but refuse to cross it, do I really have faith? I'm not living by faith. If I say, no, it looks good to me. Well, okay, then let's go over it. No, I'm good. I'm not going to do that. I'll stay right over here, but you go. Then I don't really trust it. I don't really have confidence. We might say that another way. If I won't obey, then I don't really believe. So what does it mean that the just shall live by his faith? It's both of those things acting together. He begins with confidence in God, and he will follow that with trust in the way he lives his life. Evident, visible trust in his actions. He's faithful. He's loyal to God. He believes God's promises, so he walks according to the will of the giver. When he hears what God's view of something is, God's, I won't use a word like opinion, but what does God want? What does God think about something? What does God view in this behavior? Does he say to do it or to not do it? He trusts that and will live accordingly, because he has faith that God has communicated exactly what he wants and that he will be either pleased or incensed based on my decision. And so here, our earlier two points about God's faithfulness and his judgment come into play. Remember what we said about God's judgment seen in Habakkuk. It is a certainty, but it is not necessarily swift. When the just lives by his faith, he knows that God will reward the faithful because he trusts the certainty of God's ways. But he is willing to patiently wait for those judgments to occur in God's time because he knows they will and must happen only in God's time. And so he stays the course no matter what happens. The one who lives by faith is strong in his faith. He is obedient to God. He loves God because he believes the things that God has revealed to him about the relationship we have together. And he practices that regularly, habitually. Now, if you're still open in your Bibles to Habakkuk chapter 3, our definition really goes from a clinical level to the practical in these closing verses of the prophecy. Here I think we really see the idea at work. Maybe I could have just said, what is it to live by faith? And we could have read Habakkuk 3, 17 through 19, and I could have sat down, and you'd all beat everyone else to lunch. Maybe that's the preferred way. But I think we've got a better definition this way. Practically speaking, if you live by faith, you find yourself nodding along in agreement, as Habakkuk says. Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. It doesn't matter what happens to me. It doesn't matter what happens in my country. It doesn't matter what things I might see, how long I might have to suffer through them. It doesn't matter how many evildoers are seemingly going unpunished, how much injustice might happen around me, how much we burn with the feeling of vengeance. It doesn't matter how many good things I receive in life versus evil things. It doesn't matter if I go to my grave penniless and destitute and with absolutely nothing else to my name. Yet I will trust in God. I will rejoice in the Lord. That is Habakkuk living by faith, walking by his faith. This wonderful text in chapter 2, verse 4, is applied in several ways by New Testament writers. We won't look at each of them in great detail, but by way of conclusion, let's just consider for a moment. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 38. Tim read this passage for us before we began. And the Hebrews writer there saw something of the dilemma of Habakkuk's time among his own listeners. There were some parallels, just as there are with us today, as I mentioned. He saw people who were going through a crisis, and they had need of faith that endured to the end. That's essentially the problem in Hebrews. You need endurance. It's hard right now. It's a challenge to maintain your confidence in God, but you need to. You need to stick through it. And so he reminds them that only through faith can one truly live. That's how you survive. That's how you endure. That's how you reach the end and receive the crown. You live by faith. God can't possibly be pleased otherwise. The Apostle Paul in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 11, he uses this passage first to disabuse the Galatian saints of the idea that the law could save them. How are you saved if you're a first century Gentile? First things first, go get circumcised. Start obeying the law of Moses. Then do all the other things. And, in fact, you're probably going to have to do a lot of the things because most of this is about commandment keeping. Observe the law. Make sure you do that to the exclusion of all else. Paul says that's not the idea at all. You can't earn your salvation through perfect obedience, through mere commandment keeping, through observing all the rituals of Judaism. Only by a faith that is lived can you be saved. And in Romans chapter 1, verse 17, he will, in fact, to a large degree, summarize his entire gospel with this statement. Romans chapter 1, really beginning in verse 16, I suppose, a famous verse where Paul is stating that he is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ because it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Greek, For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Living by faith is how we obtain the righteousness of God that is revealed in the gospel. And that is the gospel that saves us. So the point this morning, if you want to be saved, if you want to be considered righteous before God, how do you do that? How is that possible? And we've just seen the simple words that give us our answer. The just shall live by his faith. You walk with fidelity in all of God's ways, but you walk with the confidence that he alone can save and will save because he has promised, and I believe, as we sang a moment ago. If that is your belief this morning, act upon it. Be faithful to God. He has been faithful to you. If you need this morning to repent of sin, to be baptized into Christ for forgiveness of sin, do that. Don't delay. We stand ready to assist. If there's something that we can help you with, offer our prayers for your strength, help you and support you. We offer the chance for that as well. If there's anything we can assist with, please make your need known by coming forward as we stand and sing.